Hi, everybody. My name is Ray Rosario, and I am an alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here and very grateful to be sober, so make sure my timing is good tonight. Like I said, I'm from Newport News. My home group is the 11 o'clock 12-step group, which meets at Denby Presbyterian Church in Newport News. We have a Thursday night big book study. We have two Saturday morning meetings. 10 a.m. we have a 1-2-3-step foundation meeting, which is like a beginner's meeting. We just cover steps 1, 2, and 3 out of the 12 and 12. And then at 11 o'clock we have a step study meeting where any of the 12 steps can be studied at that meeting. So if you're ever in Newport News, we'd love to have you. We also have these meetings available in Spanish. So even if you're an alcoholico, we'd love to have you come out to us. My sobriety date is January 13, 1998. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor guys. And so I'm right where I'm supposed to be, right in the middle of this thing. So I'm just going to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I am from Bronx, New York, born and raised there. Most of my time growing up, my mom raised us by herself. My mom and dad split up when I was really young. I think it was like 4 or 5. And so she raised us by herself, two older sisters, younger brother, and a lot of dysfunction in the home in those early days. The big book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't know what those words were, but looking back, I was definitely restless, irritable, and discontent as a kid. Some of it was just my own imagination, never seemed to really like who I was and always pretended to be something different to my friends in school and all that. But some of it was real too. I had some real trauma going on as a kid. There was sexual abuse in the home, and so I was actually had a relationship with one of my sisters that was, you know, highly inappropriate. And it was one of those things where, you know, it's not something you can like brag to your friends about. And so I learned to kind of keep things inside, and I developed a skill which I honed later on in my alcoholism, the skill of making things look good on the outside while they're really dirty and ugly on the inside. And so I did that for a bunch of years, and I was always, like I said, restless, irritable, and discontent. My family's from Puerto Rico, and I'm of Spanish descent, and so when I was about 13 years old, I took a trip to Puerto Rico to visit family. My mom is the next to youngest of 19 kids, 19. So a lot of aunts and uncles, a lot of family, big family. And it was in Puerto Rico that I took my first drink. I was hanging out with one of my uncles, and he was with some of his buddies. So we were riding around in a pickup truck, and we stopped somewhere. And the guys got out, they were standing in a circle, they had the rum bottle, and they were just passing the rum bottle and just kind of drinking out of the bottle, and I was off to the side, and I went up to my uncle and said, hey, you know, I want some too. And he said, well, if you want some, you got to go get it yourself. And so I inserted myself in the circle, and then when the bottle got to me, it was about maybe this much left in the bottle, and I downed the whole thing. And they looked at me weird, like, whoa. I thought they were mad, but they weren't mad, they were impressed. They were impressed that I drank that, I didn't cough, I didn't have any kind of weird, and I drank it like it was water. It didn't affect me at all. And I don't remember having any kind of sudden compulsion to drink after that. So I don't know that I became an alcoholic in that moment, but what I do remember was the camaraderie of drinking. Like when I took that drink with these older guys, I immediately became a part of the group. Like, and they cared about what I thought, they cared about what I said, and I became addicted to that. You know, before I even became addicted to the substance itself, I loved the camaraderie of drinking. I loved hanging out with drinkers, and it was an isolated thing in that in Puerto Rico. I drank just that one time. I didn't drink again the rest of the trip, and I don't remember thinking that I needed to drink. And the rest of the trip went, you know, with no incident. I returned back home to the Bronx, went to school. I went to Performing Arts High School in New York. I was a I was a musician, and I would grow up to become a professional musician later on. And then I joined a group. I joined an orchestra, a community orchestra made up of medical doctors. And we rehearsed on Thursday nights. And so after the Thursday night rehearsals, a couple of us would go out drinking afterwards. And so I joined them. It was some kind of Irish bar in the East Village of Manhattan. Oh something, oh Hanlon's, oh Grady's, or what, I can't remember exactly. And I drank Bass Ale. Those guys taught me how to drink. And so I became a once a week Thursday night Bass Ale alcoholic. It was the only time I drank, just those Thursday nights. And again, it wasn't so much about the drink, it was more about the camaraderie of drinking. Like, I'm hanging out with these people, they're doctors, you know, they have important jobs, you know, they just, you know, they're accomplished, and they cared about what I thought. You know, they wanted to hear my opinion about stuff. And I loved it. I just loved hanging out with them. And this went on for a little while, and at some point during that time, you know, they say alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and at some point during that every Thursday night deal, something switched. It began as camaraderie, playing great music, hanging out, having a good time. That's what it was about at first. At some point it switched and it became, not right away either, very subtly, it became about the drink. Like, I couldn't wait to drink. And I mean, if you'd asked me back then, I would have said, no, I'm not an alcoholic, because I only drank just that night. Didn't drink any other time. And it didn't affect like my schoolwork. I was a straight A student in school. I never got in trouble, no police stuff. I didn't hang out on the streets. You know, so people looked at me and it was like, you know, he's just a good kid. He's just a good kid. But again, I know how to make it look good. I know how to make things look good on the outside while they're kind of crappy on the inside. And so that's what people thought of me. And I didn't think I had a problem either. Now, my mom didn't like it, because I would rehearse on these Thursday nights, and I would very often not come home at all. I mean, here I am, a kid. I live in the Bronx. These rehearsals are in Manhattan. You know, it's about an hour plus away, and I'm often on Thursday nights not making it home. I drink, you know, for a few hours, and these doctors, I tell you what, these doctors weren't alcoholics either. Like, they would drink and have a good time, and they would want to go home afterwards. They'd be like, you know, hey, I got to go to work tomorrow. But it was me that kept saying, hey, come on, let's hang in there a little while longer. And they probably drank more because of me, you know, because I kept urging them to hang in there with me. But eventually the night would come to an end, and I'd get on the train, me, my bassoon case, my book bag, and sometimes I'd pass out on the train, and the train would just go all the way up into the Bronx and back down into Manhattan while I'm passed out on the train. It's a miracle no one ever stole my instrument or my books. It's a miracle that nothing bad ever, never got mugged or anything. God was definitely looking out for me. And my mom didn't like it, and so sometimes, you know, like on Thursday mornings, you know, she'd want to say something to me, like, hey, are you going to that rehearsal tonight? And after a while, I just didn't like that confrontation, so I would like get up super early on Thursday mornings and just like leave before she would wake up, you know, just so I wouldn't have to talk to her. And when I look back on it then, you know, it's like, I really was showing alcoholic tendencies back then. You know, I think I was an alcoholic back then, because I think most kids in school look forward to the weekend. They look forward to Friday, you know, the day is over. And I was always looking forward to Thursday. Like, I couldn't wait till Thursday. I would feel like the little butterflies in my stomach. I couldn't wait till Thursday, you know. Thursday's coming, you know, it's almost here. Because that's the day that I could drink. That's the day I could drink. But again, no big consequences. I graduated high school. Went to college. I moved to Philadelphia. I went to college in Philadelphia for a year. My drinking took on a greater proportion. I drank as much as I could. I worked part-time as a waiter in a restaurant. And so I was afforded the opportunity to do some drinking there. I skipped classes. I was a straight A student in high school, but in college I skipped almost all my classes except for the playing classes. Right? If it was a group to play in, I showed up and I played. but I wouldn't show up in any kind of classroom classes at all. And so I did that for a year, and then I left Philadelphia, moved back to New York. I became a freelance musician for a couple of years. And so on one of these freelance gigs, I was playing in a woodwind quintet, and the clarinet player was quite a bit older than me. He was probably like 15, 20 years older than me. Really fantastic player, but during one of these breaks, we had a conversation. He talked to me about, he told me the story of how he avoided Vietnam because he was a clarinet player. When Vietnam was happening, they were doing the whole, you know, draft thing. He's like, you know, he had this idea that he was going to volunteer himself into the army to play clarinet, and it worked. He got with a recruiter. He played for a bandmaster. Of course, he's a great player. So they're like, yeah, we want you. And so he enlisted in the army. He played clarinet in the army and was able to avoid any kind of conflict. And I thought, that's a great idea. Not that to avoid a conflict, but it's a great idea to play in the military. And so I did the same thing. I got with a recruiter, played for a bandmaster. They liked how I played. And so I enlisted in the United States Army as a bassoon player. And I went to basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and went to the Armed Forces School of Music, not too far from here, Norfolk, Virginia. I drank during that school. I was at that school for about 7 months. And during that school, I drank every single night that I was there. We had the school, and directly across the street from the school was a place called Jimmy's. It was a bowling alley, Jimmy's Bowling Alley and Bar. I went there every night. I never bowled. I never bowled while I was there. I just drank every night. Me and two other friends of mine from the school, they were older too, and we drank every night. We'd go to school, we'd go to Jimmy's, we'd order 3 pints of beer, no glasses, we just drank straight from the pints. And we would sit there and do our homework while we were drinking. And I did that for about 7 months, the time that I was there. It did not affect my school at all. I was actually an honor graduate of the school, drunk every night. So I graduated, and then I went to my first duty station, which was in Kentucky, Fort Knox, Kentucky. Now, in Fort Knox, Kentucky, my drinking was really, really bad at Fort Knox. I drank and got stupid drunk every single night that I was at Fort Knox. Every single night. I lived in the barracks. Didn't own a car for the first couple of years that I was there. So no, I was never going to get a DUI or anything like that. You know, so I lived in the barracks. The band hall was in the same building. The chow hall was right across the street from our building. So I had no reason to get into any kind of trouble. I mean, I lived in Kentucky for 4 years and never got to see any of Kentucky. The only thing I ever saw in Kentucky was if the band went and played somewhere, then I would see that. But I never drove anywhere. I never really developed friendships out there. I mean, I had a few friends in the band, but never really got to know anybody. Didn't even play. They had like community groups, you know, in the area. I never played with any of them either. I just drank, went to work, and then get off work and drink some more. And I just did that. I did that for the 4 years that I was there, except for a 3-month period. And I want to talk about that a little bit. This 3-month period that I had in the Army where I did not drink at all. And what happened was my first sergeant from the band, he called me into his office and he said, "Ray, we really, really like you. Love how you play. Love your attitude. We really would love to send you to the promotion board, but we can't do it because you drink too much." And that was like the first time that someone had ever addressed my drinking in that way. You know, and so I just so I told First Sergeant, "Okay, I'll just quit then." You know, and I did. I quit right then and there, and it wasn't hard to quit. I didn't have shakes. Nothing bad happened. You know, I just simply stopped drinking, and everything got better. Everything got better. My PT scores went up. My work attitude was better, and people noticed it. They were like, "Wow, there's something going on with Ray, man. He's really doing an awesome job." I even played better, and I always thought drinking helped my playing. But that's not true either. I actually drank better not drinking. And so it was like, you know, and so I knew it too. Like, I'm not a dumb guy. I put two and two together. It's like, not drinking made my life better. I did that equation. And so I was like, I was really happy, you know, because people were happy with me, and I felt, and I just felt like, you know, I love being the center of attention, especially when it's good, you know, and people were impressed with me, and I liked that. And they did send me to the promotion board after a little while. And then the insidious insanity of the first drink, I didn't plan on it. You know, I wasn't thinking, hey, I got what I want, I'm going to go and get drunk now. It wasn't like that. An opportunity came to drink, and there was nothing inside of me that said, Ray, you shouldn't do it. I just simply took the drink, and then I went right back to the way it was, right away. Just drinking exactly the way I had drank before. Nothing had changed. And so I did my time in the Army. I got out. I moved back to New York. And became a freelance musician again for a couple of years. I played with an Army Reserve band in Queens, New York, and I just played gigs. And I was a composition major in college, so I did some writing too, and I would occasionally write something that someone would like and make a little bit of money here and there. But I lived with Mom and just kind of, you know, was a mooch. You know, I just didn't support myself. Never thought about like doing any kind of like real work, you know, just I'm a musician and that's all I do, and that's it. And this went on for a couple of years, and then an opportunity came with the Air Force. And the Air Force is what I really had always wanted to do. I'll tell you a quick story. As a little kid in the Bronx, I think it was in either fifth or sixth grade, something like that, but my class went on a field trip to Carnegie Hall. And I got to watch the Air Force band play in front of people. And I said, wow, that's what I want to do when I grow up. So this opportunity came to play in the Air Force. So I auditioned for a job, and I won the job. And so I enlisted. So I came back into active service and enlisted in the Air Force and was stationed in Virginia, Langley Air Force Base. And I was the principal bassoon player of the Air Force band at Langley Air Force Base. And I remember that first night that I was there at Langley. It was quite a whirlwind. It was just, I mean, I was amazed that this opportunity had come my way. I really was. I didn't think that it could. I thought that I had been in the Army before, and so maybe I couldn't come back in. But they assured me that if I won the job, that they would find a way to get me back in, and they did. They found a way to get me back into the service. And so I remember that night just walking around Langley and just thinking, wow, you know, this is amazing. I can't believe that I have the job of my dreams. I mean, I was just so thankful. I really had something of a spiritual moment. And every time I read Bill's story and he talks about walking around in Winchester Cathedral, I think about that. Like, that's the kind of feeling that I had, that Bill had in Winchester. It was like, wow, this is amazing. I had a feeling of awe. I knew God had done this for me. I was extremely thankful that God had done this for me. And I was never really a religious guy, but I knew, and I think inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And it came out that day. So I knew, and I remember talking to God and thanking him profusely, and telling him that I was going to really take this opportunity, this great opportunity that he had given to me, and I was going to make something great out of it. I was going to be the best bassoon player that the Air Force had ever had. I was going to just be this, you know, just this amazing worker. I was going to not drink anymore and just really just do some really good things, maybe go back to school, earn multiple degrees. I mean, I just had a lot of these thoughts, these really good thoughts that I had. And I was really sincere when I said all of those things. You know, it was just me and God. I was totally sincere. I wasn't lying to God. You know, I really meant everything I said. And that deep feeling, that spiritual experience that I had kept me sober for about a month. And then I got an apartment in downtown Newport News, close to the bars. And, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic without the spiritual solution. And so if you're an alcoholic like me and you're in really close proximity to bars and establishments like that, I had no defense. And so I went back to drinking again. It wasn't gradual at all. When I went back to drinking, I drank with gusto right away, and I had no control. I had absolutely no control. And then this really began a double life that I was living, which I had, as I told you earlier in my story, I had been living kind of a double life all along. You know, as a kid, I projected something on the outside and it was different on the inside. And so now I was literally living a double life where during the day I was in the Air Force band, perfect uniform, showed up 30 minutes early, ready to play, professional, everything looks good, you know, made it look really, really good. And then at night, I'm bar hopping, I'm driving around, I'm picking up hookers, I'm living this like debaucherous lifestyle. And it was always this fear of, man, I don't want the people during the day to find out what I'm doing at night. And every once in a while I would see someone from the band at night and it would scare me to death and I'd like rush off and try to go somewhere else because I just did not want, I knew what I was doing was wrong. I knew that it did not look good and I did not want them to see me. I didn't want anybody in the band to see me. I was so afraid that someone would say, man, you should have seen Ray last night. Stuff like that really, really scared me. And but what also happened was that, you know, so this is going on, and yeah, I have this fear and all this stuff, and I'm doing all this stuff, but then I also, at some point, I knew that what I was doing was going to threaten what I had. Like, I had this was the job of my dream since I was a little kid, and I knew drinking was, I was gonna lose it because of the drinking. And so I had made a decision that I was going to stop drinking. And in the Army, I made that decision, and I was able to stop just like that. But this time, I made that decision, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop at all. I mean, I had every reason in the world to stop. But I always thought about drinking, you know? And so I thought my problem was just the substance itself, but I found out that I got a mental problem too. Like, if I think about drinking, I have to drink. Like, if I think about it, I have to do it. And so I attempted to not think about drinking. This was my first kind of try at not drinking. I figured, well, I just need to occupy my mind and do other things. And so I would work, you know, work at the band, and then after work, I wouldn't go to the bar, you know, I'd drive straight home. And I would, like, you know, maybe watch a movie on TV, I'd, you know, cook, I'd love doing puzzles. I had stacks and stacks of puzzle books, and I'd sit there just doing puzzle after puzzle after puzzle, you know, just to occupy my mind, and it would work for a few hours, you know, but you can only do so many puzzles, and you know, but then, you know, that thought of drinking would come. It would come, and when it came, I was a slave to it. I was a slave to the thought of drinking, and I just didn't understand what was going on with me. I did not understand why I couldn't just simply not drink. I have all these reasons not to. Why can't I just simply put my mind to it and say, okay, Ray, you're not going to drink today. Even just for a day, you're just not going to drink today. And I couldn't do it. I absolutely could not do it. I didn't understand. I didn't understand what was going on. And I'd gotten really despondent about it. I got really depressed about it. I was stuck. I was really stuck. And so about 6 months before I got sober, I was in my neighborhood. I had worked, I'd gone home, I hadn't had anything to drink yet. This wasn't one of those days where I said, I'm not gonna drink. You know, I just kind of had given it up that day. And so I was in a 7-Eleven, I bought a couple of hot dogs, I was just gonna eat something before I went about my drinking, you know. And there was a guy in the 7-Eleven. He was upset. He was talking to the clerk. This was my neighborhood 7-Eleven. So you kind of, you don't know people, but you kind of know them. You know, you see people around and stuff, right? So this guy was upset. He was upset because someone was supposed to pick him up and take him somewhere. And I don't know where this came from because this is not my nature at all. But on that particular day, I thought, let me help this guy out. Let me take him to wherever he wants to go. And so I went up to the guy and I said, look, I know you're upset and all that, but if you want, I'll take you to wherever you want to go. He was like, oh, thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And this guy was going to an AA meeting. That guy was going to an AA meeting. And so I'm driving them to an AA meeting. I couldn't tell you what meeting it was. I don't remember anything like that. I just remember that this guy needed to go somewhere, and I was taking him, and it happened to be to an AA meeting. And so I'm driving him to the AA meeting. And while I'm driving him to the AA meeting, he keeps thanking me for being willing to do that. But he also talks about AA. And he talks about how AA has helped him and how he doesn't drink anymore. And I don't remember any of the real specifics about the conversation. I just remember that this guy was happy. I don't know that he was deliriously happy, but he was like happy enough. Like, I was a miserable guy. But he was happy enough that he wasn't drinking anymore and all this stuff, and that AA had helped him, right? And so we got to the place. Little piece of me said, maybe I should go in there with him. So that's a little piece of me. But I quickly got rid of it. I said, hey, have a good time, whatever. And I left, and I went about my drinking. But if you ever heard in meetings, where AA will ruin your drinking, it's true. It's true. Because after that encounter, when I would drink, I would think about that guy. I would think about that guy. I wonder what he's doing. I wonder what's going on with him. I didn't know anything about AA, so I couldn't really formulate anything like that. But I just knew that guy wasn't drinking, and I was drinking. And I didn't want to drink, but I was drinking. It didn't move me, like it affected me, but it didn't move me enough to like pick up the phone or try to reach out to AA or anything. I just thought I was stuck in my misery and I was just going to keep on doing it, and that was it. So it affected me, but not to the point of action. And so this went on for a little while. The band played a concert in Williamsburg, a Christmas concert in Williamsburg, and it would prove to be my last concert with the band. I did not know that at the time, but we played the concert. Then I went on leave, and I went back to New York. I tried to rekindle an old relationship, but she didn't want anything to do with me because I'd stolen money from her and did all kinds of terrible things to her. So she didn't want anything to do with me. And of course, I'm angry. I'm pissed off. Of course, I'm drinking all the time still, and it's just I'm just angry at the world. I'm just angry at the world. I felt like the world had given me a raw deal. I hated everybody, in spite of the fact that I had the job of my dreams. I was like, I hated everything. And all I could think about was dying. And so I'm on this, I'm on leave, and then it's time for me to come back to work from leave. And then on the way back from leave, I just decided not to come back to work. I was stopped at a light, waiting for the light to change. And when the light changed, instead of proceeding forward to go back home, I took a U-turn and I said, I'm going to go AWOL. And I decided to go AWOL. I went AWOL from the band. I'm still the only person I know that's ever gone AWOL from the band. And so I went AWOL, decided not to go back to work. And I made the decision in that moment that I'm going to drink myself to death, because I knew I was never going to stop drinking. And I know I was going to lose everything anyway, so I might as well put an end to this thing. And so I tried to drink myself to death. And I would just drive somewhere, find a place to drink, a bar usually, and drink as much as I could. I'd pass out. I'd hope to not come to, but I would come to. I'd be pissed off at God because I came to. And then I would just kind of get in my car and drive somewhere else. And I just drove aimlessly different places. And so I drove all the way up, New England. I was in Montpelier, Vermont. Did the same thing. I drank. I passed out. I didn't want to come to. I came to. I was pissed off at God because I came to. And I just kept going and kept going and kept going. And so the day before my sobriety date, on January 12th, 1998, I came to. I was pissed off. Same deal. I drove somewhere. I drove to Concord, Massachusetts. I'd never been there before. I had no reason to be there. I didn't have friends there. I didn't work there. I'd never been there in my travels before. That's just the place that I happened to be, Concord, Massachusetts. And I did the same thing. I drank, I passed out. I passed out in my car in a municipal parking lot. I came to, and when I came to, I was pissed off at God again. And I was like, okay, well, I need to go somewhere else. I need to do this again. But the circumstances were different on January 13th. When I came to, I didn't have any cash. So I'm like, okay. And then I didn't have any gas in the car either. But I had money in the bank, so I was like, okay, I gotta walk now. So I'm gonna walk and find an ATM. I'm gonna get some money out. And I'm going to, you know, buy a gas can, put some gas in the car, and, you know, and then go about my thing, right? But I couldn't get any money out that day. I went to every ATM I could find and trying to take money out, and I couldn't get any money out. And I didn't understand what was going on. I found out later on that the Air Force had frozen my bank account. But I didn't know that then. I just knew that I would call the bank and they'd say, oh, you got $1,000-something in the bank. And I was like, you know, hey, I got some money, you know, but I couldn't get it. I couldn't get to it. And so, but now it's like, I want a drink. I need a drink now. I need one. I'm starting to shake. I mean, I'm starting to have some really, really bad adverse reactions in my body. And I couldn't get a drink. And I wanted one bad. My sobriety date, I probably wanted a drink more on my sobriety date than any other day, that day. But I couldn't get that drink. And so what happened? What am I gonna do, you know? Because actually, what I wanted was happening. Like, I felt like I was dying. But it wasn't the quiet death that I wanted. I wanted to pass out, not come to, kind of thing, right? No, this wasn't happening. This was like body convulsing, really hurting. And it's like, I really learned, you know, that it wasn't that I wanted to die. I just didn't want to hurt anymore. This is really what was going on. I didn't want to hurt anymore. And I was hurting so bad that day. And then I heard a voice. I believe it was God talking to me. Didn't quote scripture, didn't say anything profound or anything like that. He just said, turn yourself into the police. That's what I heard. Turn yourself into the police. And I saw a cop and I went right up to that cop. And I told him what was going on. And then a series of events, that cop drove me to the nearest Air Force base, got me in contact with the military police there. I told them, you know, they asked me questions and they had forms for me to fill out because when you go AWOL, I guess anything you do in the military, there's a form for it. And so there's the AWOL form, I guess you want to call it. So I'm filling out the form and it's asking me questions about being suicidal and about drinking. And I answered the questions as honestly as I could. I wasn't trying to BS them at all like I always had been before. I was honest with them. I wasn't honest because I was an honest guy. I was honest because I was a desperate guy. And so I told them the truth. They're like, hey, you know, we need to get somebody to talk to you. And so they got a psychiatrist. They got a military psychiatrist. And this lady talked to me for a while. And I was honest with her, too. And it was this lady that said, you're an alcoholic. And you need to go to a hospital right away. And they made arrangements and whisked me to a civilian hospital, Emerson Hospital in Concord, Massachusetts. And doctors and nurses took care of me. But there was an AA group meeting in that hospital that night. And the nurses knew it, and they knew that I needed to be in that meeting. And so they took me to my first AA meeting. It was the First Things First group in Concord, Massachusetts at Emerson Hospital. I was the only person in that meeting that was a patient of the hospital. Everybody else was normal, looked like you guys, you know, nice clothes, they look happy, all that, right? I got a hospital gown on, I got the pole with the IV, I got the gown that doesn't close all the way in the back, you know. I'm just looking like pathetic, real pathetic. I'm the obvious newcomer in the room, They did chips at the end of the meeting. I did not get up to get a white chip. The chairman instead walked over to me and put a white chip in my hand. And he said, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. And that was January 13th, 1998, and haven't had a drink since. And I think about that day often. And something in the big book, it talks about the miracle of healing. yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbled himself, and then he knew. And that's what happened to me. I did not come to that morning with the intention of being sober, but the circumstances humbled me. The circumstances were bad, and I felt bad, and for once in my life, I made the right decision when it came to drinking, and I just decided I needed to obey the voice. The voice telling me to turn myself into the police. You know, I obeyed the voice. I never obeyed that inner voice. God was always trying to talk to me. He was always trying to get me to do the right thing. And I sometimes would hear that voice, but I would always suppress it. It's like, I want to do my thing. But on that day, I obeyed the voice. On that day, when the voice told me, when the voice gave me that good, orderly direction, I actually listened. I actually listened and tried to do the right thing. And then when the military police and the psychiatrists were talking to me about drinking, I told them the truth too. And so I think my sobriety date is a good one because I was honest about my drinking for the very first time in my life that day, the very first time. Of course, that alone has not kept me sober all these years. The next day, the Air Force sent an escort to pick me up from that hospital. He accompanied me to the airport, and we flew to Washington, D.C., and I was admitted into a treatment facility on Andrews Air Force Base, and it was there that I got my education about alcoholism and about AA. They took us to outside AA meetings. At my first outside of a facility AA meeting, a guy there just happened to, he bought me my first big book in 12 and 12. Couldn't tell you who he is today, but he bought me my first big book in 12 and 12 and really wasn't interested in reading the big book or the 12 and 12. But, you know, when you're in treatment, there's nothing better to do. So, you know, I kind of opened the big book and went through the table of contents, and I saw a chapter entitled To Employers. And so that's the first thing I ever read in the big book was To Employers. And of course, my motive was clear. I wanted to read something. I thought maybe this could help me with the job, and maybe they wouldn't kick me out, you know, that kind of thing, right? So I read the first, you know, maybe page and a half of Two Employers. And if you're not familiar with Two Employers, it's basically an employer talking about how he didn't understand alcoholism and he had a couple of people commit suicide. And he would say, you know, because he just didn't understand alcoholism. And so, I don't know, I liked that guilt trip. I thought, hey, this is good, you know? And I had this idea. It's like, I'm gonna make photocopies of these pages, and I'm gonna give it to my employer. And I thought it was a great idea. I really did. I was so convinced that it was a great idea that the next morning, in our little group session that we had in treatment, I told them in the group about my idea, and they all laughed at me. They laughed at me. They said, "Ray, you're full of it. Don't do that." They were convincing. They were convincing, and so I didn't do it. I didn't do it. And I learned later on that was a form of step three. That was a form of step three where I step three, turned their will and life over to the care of God as we understood Him. And my first sponsor always explained to me that your will is what you think and your life is what you do. And so to turn it over, you know, you tell the group what you're thinking about doing, you tell the group what you are doing, you let the group influence you. That's what happened. I told that group what I was thinking about doing, what I was going to do. And the group laughed at me and they told me I was dumb and crazy and not to do it, and then I didn't do it. So I turned it over in that small way, but I learned how to turn it over. After the treatment was over, a couple of guys from the Air Force Band came and picked me up. They took me back to Langley. They informed me that that the band had made a decision, that they decided that they were going to kick me out of the Air Force. And I was devastated by that, but of course these military things don't happen quick. Not like they tell you that they kick you out and you're gone the next day. It takes time. They gotta do paperwork and do all kinds of things. And so in the meantime, they had, I had a doctor from the base that I had to report to every week, and he reported to the band, like told them what my progress was. So I thought, well, let me impress this doctor. if I impress this doctor enough and he gives the band really good reports about me, maybe the band will change their mind and not kick me out. And so that became my mission, was to impress the doctor. How did I impress the doctor? I went to meetings every day. I got a sponsor. And even though I didn't work the steps right away, I became involved. I started doing some little service work, like I would help with chairs, and I would make coffee every once in a while, and but I was there every day. I was going to meetings every single day. I wanted the people in AA to see that I was serious about what I was trying to do, and I also I just wanted to impress this doctor. I wanted this doctor to see that, hey, I became I'm a different guy. You should tell the band, man, this guy's serious. This guy's really going to be sober, and that you should be able to keep him in the band. It worked in that the doctor was impressed with me, and he did tell the band all these great things about what I was doing and, you know, trying to do. But it didn't work because the band had made up their mind. They decided that I was just too much trouble, that I had done, that I'd gone too far, done too many bad things. I was too discredited to be able to stay in the band. So I did get kicked out of the band. By this time I'd had a home group, the 25th Street group in downtown Newport News, and they met on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. I got kicked out on a Tuesday. I remember one of the NCOs had called me into his office. He said, hey, everything has come to fruition. You need to go to out processing, and you're going to be discharged from the Air Force. And so I was devastated that day. I went to out processing. They took the sticker off my car. They took my ID away. They said, you're never allowed back on Langley Air Force Base ever again. And I left. But it was a Tuesday, and my home group met on a Tuesday. And so I went to my home group that night, and I told them what had happened, and they just told me to keep coming back. And so I survived that. You know, it had gotten rough for me life-wise. The money ran out. I couldn't get a job for a while. I got evicted from an apartment. I moved into a hotel, Patton Motel in Newport News. Started doing day labor work. I just needed to do that because I just needed to make enough money so I could pay my hotel stay for that night, you know. And something really weird happened. I developed something that I'd never had before: a work ethic. I worked every day. I was responsible. I showed up. I had a good attitude, and the outside was like really crappy. My outside life was really crappy, but the inside started to get well. So it was a total change. Of course, I was still discontent because, I mean, you know, my life was kind of in the crapper, even though I was feeling better. But they kept convincing me. They said, Ray, you keep doing what you're doing, eventually it'll come back. Like, eventually the outside will start to match the inside. Your life will get better. And it did. Staying sober, I was able to get out of the whole hotel situation. I had gotten one of the people I was temping for. They hired me on to work for them, and I moved up the ranks. I lost that job, but then I got the job that I have now. I've been on the same job for 17 years. Never was able to do that before. Never. Started doing some more service work. Became a GSR of my home group. They found out that I was a Spanish speaker, and so I started doing Spanish AA. I brought Spanish AA into the Hampton and Newport News. We tried it in Williamsburg for a little while. It didn't quite work out there, but all of these different things that I tried to do, and it wasn't always successful, but it really enriched my life. It really enriched my life and my sobriety. I feel so close to God today. I know that everything I have, I really don't deserve it. you know, but I'm glad I've got it though. I'm glad I've got it. And so I try to show my gratitude in everything I do. I try really hard not to say no to any AA request that comes my way. I try to be of service in every capacity possible. You know, in my first home group, we had a guy, little Tracy. He would always say that he was grateful, but he just wasn't grateful enough. And what he said, what he meant was that he could never give back to AA what AA had given to him, but that he was going to keep on trying to do it. And that's my life today. Like, I'll never be able to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what Alcoholics Anonymous has given to me. But I'm going to keep on trying, and I'm going to keep on trying really hard not to say no to an AA request. And so I would say to anybody, because my first sponsor also said that I was a cookie cutter alcoholic. I was just average run-of-the-mill alcoholic. There was nothing special about me. But that the program that works for the guy over there is the same program that's going to work for me. And so all I have to do is have the willingness and try to do that next right thing. I don't even have to work this program perfectly. I can make all kinds of mistakes. But if I'm just trying to do this thing one day at a time, remarkable things can happen. So I would tell anybody who's brand new to this thing, you don't need to be especially gifted in anything. You don't need to be an eloquent speaker. You don't need to have special skills. If you're a guy, if you're someone that used to drink and doesn't drink anymore, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not too discredited to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I was too discredited to be in the band after a while, but I've never been too discredited to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that I am eternally grateful. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for that, Ray. That